which is a study of the mores, the moral beliefs and practices of our community, is chiefly a challenge to formulate and to embody a public philosophy in the light of a situation in which there is very little attention today, according to them, to the public philosophy or the public virtue or public morality. This book is a study, allegedly, growing out of 200 interviews of white middle-class people. The exact methodology for the choice is not revealed, but these five scholars, four sociologists and one philosopher, assert that they did it with care. One of the chief criticisms of the book is that it's not true of our common life or of our life, that it overemphasizes certain things. It doesn't take into account, and if you read the review on the bulletin board, on the resource board in the dining room, you'll see that that's one of the strong criticisms. But I think it's worth some time. There's no way to deal with the richness of their reporting on these 200 interviews in one session. Mostly what I can do for you is to encourage you to read the book, but I'll give an overview which involves my own understanding of reality, largely via Paul Tillich, into which framework all of this can fit, I believe. So you get an overview of the thrust of the book, and then you can read the book and fill it in. Paul Tillich wrote in 1947 that we lived at the end of the Protestant era. That is, we live at the end of the age in which the Protestant principle will be the dominant informing principle of our culture. His thesis was that it had been the informing principle, the visionary principle of our culture since the Protestant Reformation. The essence of the Protestant principle is the focus on the left-hand side of this diagram and on the profane. That is to say, it's an emphasis upon the individual. We call it individualization, the focus on the person. The authors here say that our culture is embodying what they call ontological individualism. The really real thing in life is the individual. It's an emphasis upon dynamics or change or flow. And it's emphasis upon freedom. Now, not freedom as was suggested by the speaker last night. Not Protestant freedom, not Luther's freedom, but freedom of self-initiation, that is freedom to do generally whatever the self feels is good to do, or whatever gives the self satisfaction. Tillich said that we're at the end of the creative period of this reality, this focus, and it's represented in laissez-faire capitalism, the emphasis upon individual enterprises acting in such a way as to maximize their profits, do what will build up them. It's an end to democracy, thought of as simply the vote, elections in which people simply vote without regard to what they vote for, or without a concern for what they vote for. It's an end to permissiveness in education, in which the student is assumed to know better than anybody else what should be the content of his education. He's allowed to choose. Tillich said that that focus had led to all kind of breakdowns, and the breakdowns in this focus could be seen in the rise of communism and fascism, where the focus is on the other side, on participation. That is to say, you have an entity which formulates and controls a reality, and you participate in it with a certain denial of your own individualism, or for your own individuality, a denial of your freedom to do as you please. That both communism and fascism were attempts to overcome the results. His analysis was that this had led to the World War and to the rise of communism and fascism with all the problems. Now, he called this the Catholic substance. And the Christian faith, in some way, is a combination of the Protestant principle for him and the Catholic substance. Catholic substance is really represented in church history by the early church, and the church all the way up, well, still some, but all the way up, particularly, to the Protestant Reformation, where the center of the church's life was to formulate the content of love through schools, through churches, through hierarchies, through all kinds of, you might call, aristocratic sources, and then to inform the culture with that vision of what love meant. It wasn't a matter of coming up from the bottom and asking people what they wanted or what they thought or felt, as much as it was scholars, priests, so-called elites, formulating what was good, what was Christian, and informing. So it was a socialization with the substance as seen through some elites. Now, Tillich's thesis is, and I follow him here, I really live out of this analysis, is that I put the arrows in here, that history is a movement. It's a dialectical movement from one side to the other, and you never know what's going to bring life. It's a matter of historical judgment. What focus in this structure of reality does our time need? That's the issue. And we have the other, the vertical dimension, which you have the sacred and the profane, and I can say this is a one-dimensional view of reality. This is a two-dimensional view of reality. Use Herbert Marcuse's famous book on these two dimensions. In a two-dimensional view of reality, there is an underlying reality. There is a whole with a substance which one seeks to discover. And if it's a dynamic whole, then one has to rediscover it in every period of history. It isn't given with any permanent form, although there are forms. I didn't do much with this side, but I will in a minute. At any rate, the theory is that in a one-dimensional view, it's a flat, and there aren't ultimates. There are only penultimates. There just isn't a fundamental under. You might call this the phenomenal view of reality. What is, and that's all there is. Whatever you experience is, whatever the society is. This is Talcott Parsons. You know, you take the functioning society, you get the mores of it, and then you socialize so people can fit into this society. In this view, there is an underlying ultimate reality which brings meaning and life and health and humanity. And you got to discover it, because it doesn't, life is a mixture of good and evil. You can't discover it on the basis of what you experience. You've got such a mixture of healthy and unhealthy reality. So you have to find a way down into that reality. Revelation has always been thought of as the revealing, in some sense, of, with all the subjective factors, of this underlying reality, God. And we've got to find that. And out of that orientation, you learn what to do in your freedom. So you could say, as was said last night, that freedom in this view would be freedom bound to the good, or bound to the structure reality which you cannot deny, bound to the ecosphere structure, which if you do certain things to it, will let the ultraviolet rays through. And today, when you take your sun baths, you are getting more ultraviolet rays and more cancer. It's clear. That's destiny. That's the structure of reality. And then it's bound to forms, not to a constantly changing forms of life, but to forms which have a kind of eternal meaning. But don't, you know, in this view, you're participating in realities. You're participating in truth. You're participating in communities. You're participating in the biblical tradition. And the participation in that tradition is set over against whatever you are in your own individual life and in your freedom. But life is a dialectical movement. And who knows? I want you to realize, who knows where we are? Who knows whether our society has moved too far in one direction or the other direction? Medieval period was thought to be too much here, and over against that we tried to get free. We tried to free up people to act and to find new ways of appropriating tradition, to find new ways of living which would have more humanness, more God in them. Well, now, this book is an attempt to depict where we are today, and it puts us right over here, very extremely. And the people in opposition say that isn't quite true. I mean, and Paul Ayn, and we just had a big discussion about it. When we visited them, we always have discussions here. We always seem to come down differently. And I want to emphasize that. We had a seminar for 6 years at the Divinity School in the University of Chicago. We had Phil Hefner, some of you know, and Bob Benny, and Franklin Sherman, and Whiting Schrader from CTS, and Gib Winter, who went to Princeton, myself. And we always came down in different places. Everybody had the same background. Everybody was sophisticated. Everybody knew too much. And we came down in different places. I can't explain why. I'm conditioned to come down over here. And I come down over here, and I don't pretend that that's the Christian way to come down. All I say is that's where I come down, and I have a bias in that direction for some reason. So I want to explain, you know, my bias. And I have a bias toward thinking we're in this country over here. So I like this book.
It agrees with me.
Right. It says everything I've been saying and thinking. Not everything, but enough of it. So, where am I now? I think I've given you the general overview. You could take a view of this in traditional versus modernity, traditionalism versus modernity, in terms of sociological categories, and you would get pretty much the same notion. And the interest I've had for the last 10, 15 years is in moving in the direction of the right-hand side of these polarities. Some of you know that's why we formed our intentional Christian community, which seeks to embody some of the principles on the right-hand side. Well, in a traditional society, you would have, and I give these big categories, and don't I don't want to scare anybody by them. All I'm trying to say is that that thing isn't working well. Somebody know why it isn't? Doesn't seem to work. You could take the principles of modernity, which would emphasize the universalism of a person. So you deal with some universal aspect of a person. You have a dentist who deals with your teeth, and a specialist that deals with your pancreas, and a specialist, you know, that deals with your left toe. And you have all these specialists who deal with some particular aspect, a psychiatrist, and you deal with people in terms of what's a universal characteristic of the person. But you seldom deal with the whole person. And in traditional society, you deal with what they call particularism, or the particular. You deal with the whole person, particular person. So in our intention community, we're trying to relate to fewer people, but in all the aspects. Of course, it's impossible because you can't provide everything. But then the other is achievement. You get your status by achievement. You got to earn it. And here you get it by ascription. That is to say, you're born into it, more or less. You don't have to earn your way in a family. We know that that's not true, but... But in theory, at least, if you're part of a kinship, you take care of each other, and you have a black sheep. My second son flunked out of Oberlin twice. I don't think anybody else in the history of Oberlin has that distinction.
Special.
He did. I won't tell you what he's doing now, but he is a black sheep, really. But he's still part of the family. Well, the problem is to deal with your black sheep. And love them and accept them, you know. They don't have to earn it. We say, me Luther, you Lutheran, I'm a combination of everything. Methodist, Baptist, Disciple, UCC. Anyway, and Luther. Went to Lutheran Church for 4 years. We were up here. Now this is what, our eighth year, ninth year? Anyway, ascription, grace. That's grace. You are a part of the body of humanity, whatever happens to you. All right, here you got to achieve. Everything's achievement. What do they call this other one? I got to look. It's effective neutrality. I remember. These are real terms, aren't they? These highfalutin sociologists, but they're meaningful terms. That means that you don't have any feelings for the people you deal with. In your job, if you're a psychiatrist or you're whatever you are, you deal with them as a client. And you go home at 5 o'clock and you forget about them. And you don't get involved emotionally. And of course, this is effective. I'm not sure this is the term that's used, but involvement. I was told by Andy Gordon that there's a guy who takes wards of the state and places them, and he won't take social workers in his homes. He won't take them, and you can only stay there 2 years because he knows you're going to burn out if you take care of your kids. And the social worker goes home at 5 o'clock, because the social worker is professionalized. You know, and you have a professional attitude, and you deal with something that's wrong with the kid, but not with the kid. If you deal with the kid, you got to do something more. And I guess this is a so-called secular, or profane, I haven't got that right. Anyway, and here you have the holy Or you have the other dimension, and again, this is really Talcott Parsons' description of modernity, and this is a description of traditional society. Now, from a Tillichian point of view and from my point of view, you've got to have both of these. And you can't reject all of that, or you're going to destroy life. And this book is a depiction of the way in which, I guess you've seen those terms long enough. They interview these 200 people, and they pick out four kind of prototypes, and they give them to you in the first chapter. But everything comes down, for the most part, over on this side. You remember that I've got this dialectic going here. Same dialectic I've had, and this is utilitarian. I don't know why sociologists always have to have these big words. Utilitarian individualism. That means that the people they study, for the most part, and it's always a mixture, but for the most part, were interested in the utility of anything they did for themselves. That is to say, they're interested in their success, their career pattern, not failing, interested in doing well what they were doing, regardless of anything else. They do it well. Without the connections, it also was, at the pane up here, it also, there wasn't any morality much involved in it. It wasn't because it was good to do. It was just to do whatever you do and do it well. Utility. The utility of it earned you a good living and it earned you status. And with the money you could buy things you wanted, and there that involved you in the other, what they call expressive individualism. And that meant that you did what felt good. Whatever felt good. Your values were rooted in your feelings. It wasn't a matter of having values or goods or things you wanted that you thought were somehow important for the whole of society or helped other people as well as yourselves. But it was a question, unless that happened to make you feel good. It wasn't because it was moral, because you felt good in helping somebody else. And for the most part, they say Americans don't have a public morality in which they feel good about helping somebody else. It's pretty much rooted in themselves as individuals or in their families, conjugal or the small family. So what they depict then, in all spheres, in terms of citizenship, in terms of all ways of life, is this kind. Now, they do say that there are other factors going in our society, and they, biblical tradition, and what they call a republicanism. Now that's a republican political tradition. That's really the tradition of the founding fathers, who were supposed to be philosophers, who studied the good and became trained in thinking about what was good for the state. This is the republican political tradition. They say there are elements of that, and they illustrate. But for the most part, when you get on this side, and the institutions are the church, and the voluntary associations, and the do-gooders, the voluntary associations. And the family. In other words, the carriers of the pressure away from this rampant individualism are these institutions, and they're here. But even in the religion, if you read the chapter on religion, the religion has very little to do, for the most part, except where you get the crazy people in the hierarchies of the church who are always worrying about the public issues. But for the most part, the churches are not interested. But these are mitigating this individualism. They're communities. And they're certainly... the personal and interpersonal relations are part of these institutions, and they develop. But generally speaking, insofar as there's morality, it's a kind of private morality. Even over here in these institutions, it's a private morality which deals with personal and interpersonal relations. Now I'm going to give you my big bias, and then I'm going to shut up. I think, I'm hesitant to do it. No, I do want to say about implications of this afterwards. But I think that since we don't have a public morality, it's a very difficult thing to get a public morality. Given the size of our society, you could have a public morality in a small community and deal with the issues of the community. But when you try to deal with I always say, the rediscount rate, what do you do about the rediscount rate? And that's a central thing in our economy, is where that rediscount rate is set by the Federal Reserve Board. It affects the whole life of everybody. What do you do about it? How do you know what you do about it? How do you know who you should put in this chairman, Paul Volcker or somebody else, because of what he'll do? It's a very crucial decision. How do you know? Anyway, my theory is that since we don't have the public morality, we have to rationalize. And so we say that if you seek your own good, and you seek it vigorously, hard work, seek it vigorously, whatever your own good is, that out of the interaction of private ends, what comes the good? I think that's the second American dilemma. First, as you may recall, was Gunnar Myrdal, who said that we want to treat everybody who's human as equal. That's part of our whole tradition, and it's part of our Christian tradition. In order not to treat the black person as an equal, we have to declare that he's not human. And for a number of years, that was Myrdal's thesis.
The Indians also.
Indians the same. You can tell my bias there. I work with Operation Push. I think we face this kind of a rationalization in our society, that the interaction of private expressions of the good or private ends produces the good for everything. That then allows us not to have to seek the good, the public good, which is a heck of a job. Let me then just finish by pointing out the implications of this book, if it's true, and my analysis, if it's half true, for the local church. The local church would then be involved in substantive discussions of what the public good is. We've tried to do that in our local church. We've been studying Central America for 3 years in our local church. I didn't know what I was really, I mean, this is a nice rationalization for what we're doing. Holden Village would take the form of Ghost Ranch in New Mexico, where you go there and you have seminars for 2 weeks, and you get people who are interested in subjects, people in the church who are interested in different subjects, and you write papers. I went there once, and we produced a book out of it on energy. People interested in energy, and you come for 2 weeks, and you get involved with a group of people around a common interest, about a search for the good. And according to this book, that's where real community comes, where you get together with people who are seeking the good. One of the great things about Holden is you find people like that here, all over the place, and that association with other people seeking the good and trying to find morality that makes sense is a great gift here. But we need to systematize, it seems to me, in Holden, the effort so that it's more systematic. Because these problems are complex and they take years, really, to wrap yourself around them. If you're serious about the public good, you will attend to something and not everything. That's why we picked Central America. We picked something, and we couldn't pick everything. We also got involved in nuclear because it was a group interest in nuclear. And if you've got that kind of people, you probably need groups who seek to wrap themselves around a phase of the common good, which they can then share with other people for years. My own sense is, in 3 or 4 more years, some of us in our church are going to know about Central America enough to be more informed than the senators and representatives who've got to make all these big decisions. At any rate, the implication for the schools. The schools do not consider public morality. We're afraid of it. Neither are lower schools nor our universities. Our universities have, for the most part, given up on the notion of educating people in the humanities. And we used to have a 4-year college program at the University of Chicago, and you had to know humanities, social science, biological science. 4 years you studied general education. Then gradually the departments wanted more of the people, wanted to get them out faster, and the kids were more interested in what was useful, utilitarian, got them into the system, and they gave up on that. Schools got to go back. If this is true, and the results, the destructive results, are as true as some of us think of this, and that's another matter of judgment. You've got to go back. Campus ministry right now would focus not on the externals of campus life, but on the central issue. What is the vision of the public good? And that's the issue. And since the schools don't do it, then the campus ministry, if he's representing Christ and God and the effort to get at the holy and the sacred, as it's embodied in our created world, would have to go back to that. Anyway, I can talk about a few other things. Politicians would have to begin to study and become ethicists and political scientists instead of just people who are popular. We want philosophers for our politicians. You're not going to get easy agreement, but at least people who have thought systematically for a number of years about what the public good is. And the citizens would be involved in the same sort of operation. Our parties would think much more about program than about power. Well, I think that's enough to give you an indication of the significance of this book for me. So we have some time for discussion. Hope somebody's read it.
Just read portions. Would you say that the book is more an evaluation to discuss where we are rather than directives toward where we might go?
It's more an empirical description. And it's, of course, weighted, and they agree in their last postscript on social science that they are, you know, you don't write social science. There's no objective science, social science particularly. You could say that about physical science, certain, that there are theories of reality which differ with which you approach your study, even of the physical and biological science, but in the social science particularly. The prescriptions are very scanty. What you do about it. You know, I think I've said more about what you do about it than they do, although they say we've got to reevaluate and reappropriate the biblical and republican traditions, which would mean, so far as I can see, that you'd come out of serious discussions about the good. Problem is, it's very hard to get discussions about the rediscount rate out of the Bible. I only use that as an illustration. Everything is complex. I mean, and I don't mean that by making it complex that it's not understandable and that if you penetrate and stay with something, you will get it. One of the great things that the book reveals in a very strange way is that our social scientists have not been responsible. They've stood with this kind of distance. And it's very interesting because at one point in this book, the authors quote someone who says, what you ought to be doing in teaching is to expose your loves to your students. If you don't expose your love, you haven't provided them with any ground for their life. Instead of being just technical or kind of neutral about ways of life and cultures through the humanities, you are really exposed. Now, we're really leery of people exposing their loves because it gives all our biases. We don't somehow want anybody to be exposed to biases. But I think of a teacher, I always expose myself, just like I do today. I tell you where I am. And that then you can evaluate what I say on the basis of the... But, you know, at the end of the book they're talking about what's needed, talking about the poverty of affluence. And based on Hobbes, Hobbes said to consider them behind is glory. He's talking about how you look at other people. If they're behind, then it's great. To consider them before is humility. To fall on the sudden is disposition to weep, to fail. To see another fall is disposition to laugh. Continually be outgone, outdone, I think, is misery. Continue to outgo, outdo the next before is felicity, and to forsake the course is to die. Now he's describing a view of what people, humanity is. So the general inclination of mankind is a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceases only in death. Well, then they go on down to talk about their own position. And every time they precede their recommendation with perhaps.
They're edgy.
Here they're talking about love, exposing love. They cannot do it. I mean, our great neutral social scientists. We have been undercut by our intellectual tradition. It has refused to be responsible for a public morality. And we've been undercut, of course, by all of our institutions, which are the same way. And I think the right wing now at least has recognized that the right wing of the churches that there should be responsible for a public morality. I don't happen to agree with their morality, particularly in believing. I think in this interaction of private interests or private ends is leading to the good, but nevertheless they at least have gone in the right direction. They've said the Christian faith has got something to say about our public life. So they say perhaps life is not a race whose only goal is being foremost. Perhaps true felicity does not lie in continually outgoing or outdoing the next before. Perhaps the truth lies in what most of the world outside the modern West has always believed, namely that there are practices of life in themselves that are inherently fulfilling, regardless of the consequences. Perhaps work that is intrinsically rewarding is better for human beings than work that is only extrinsically rewarding. That's work that is based upon utilitarian individualism. That is, that there's something meaningful in the work for itself, and not just because of the fact that it's the end. Instrumentalism would be another word here, that your work is simply an instrument to something else. Perhaps enduring commitment to those we love and civic friendship toward our fellow citizens are preferable to restless competition and anxious self-defense. Perhaps common worship, in which we express our gratitude and wonder in the face of the mystery of being itself, is the most important thing of all. Now, they have gone a little bit to come down here, you know, compared to most social scientists.
This project of searching for the public good, does that imply that there's a common public? There's one world here?
It implies, I think, that if we search together for the good, we might create a community. We might create a common world. We might create it.
It's not implying that there is a common public. Search for the public good.
Well, I think I remember, maybe I want to remember, that there are assertions in here that suggest my position, which is that we are all related under God, in God, and that there is a community already established which has to be brought out. But
it's not the perception necessarily of the society that that is the case.
Oh no, and it's not the perception, it's not the belief of most of us.
They make quite a bit of the fact that in the United States society, it is especially difficult to create a sense of the common good because of our great diversity. It's easier in Sweden to have a sense of homogeneity. It's easier in Japan, I think, where there's always been kind of a xenophobia about the foreign, so they've resisted the foreign. Our tradition has incorporated all sorts and varieties of human, we've basically been open to that. There's a diversity here that Sweden doesn't have. But I think what I lack in the book, from what I've read of it, is a sense of the global community. They really are talking about the U.S. society. And I think it's a mistake to continue to look for the common good only in national terms. And Chernobyl and the U.S. relationship with the people south of the Rio Grande ought to tell us that we have to look now in global terms. And that makes it even more difficult to find the common good, because basically all of our politics is in terms of national self-interest.
Because it's difficult, however, doesn't mean it isn't the direction we are.
I think the church can contribute to that very difficult task of thinking globally rather than nationalistically.
I think our church is now prepared to try to get enough contact with Nicaragua, in particular, although we're working on contacts in Guatemala and El Salvador, to share something. I mean, move in that direction. I think all we can do is begin to move in the direction we think is important, however difficult it be. If that's what we need, that's where we need to go.
And you're trying to do it not with ideas and issues, but with people, right? With exchange of people.
With people.
Personalize it. Yeah.
I think you got to personalize it. I just think that personal experience with the same is true with the underclass in this country. How do you make common life? How do you all take them into account? And we live with the underclass, with our community.
Now, the only ways in world history that's happened is when the minorities have had their mouths shut. Isn't it true? When you get a common world, you have to shut a bunch of mouths. And so what we're working for, you say this is what we need, this book says what we need a common world. But all the examples of it is when people have had their mouths shut.
But I don't know.
Every time I've been involved in a group that's moved towards a common world, a common public, I've seen mouths shut all over the place. I've seen our church. Trying to get a church together, they're shutting mouths all over the place.
I don't think you have to shut mouths, though. I think there are
two... Why do you believe that?
Well, I'll be talking about that on Thursday, if you want the detail of it, when I talk about a violent way of life or being versus a nonviolent. In a violent way of being, it's a win-lose situation always. And so if you win, I lose. But I think you have to find a way of looking at other people. So you have to eliminate the people on the other side, because if they have a chance to win, you're going to lose.
In your Operation Push, you work with the Black Muslims?
Some.
Now those folks, what I know about Black Muslims, with my friends in that movement, they just don't trust. And when I come in looking for a common good, they say, there you are again. I know what your agenda is, you son of a bitch. I know what you're after. You're after shutting my mouth.
Yeah. Well,
because power corrupts, and you get a common public, and you've got power. Look at the power there would be in a common public.
Yeah. Well, that's, if you take the balance of interest view of politics, and they discuss that in detail in this book, that's one way of looking at politics, is the interaction of interests. And I happen to think that that's a regulative principle, but it can't be a constitutive principle. The good will not emerge from just organizing. I spend my life organizing blacks, literally, for pushing them into the system by virtue of power. But that's not necessarily going to produce the good. For the time being, blacks will say that if you bring up these other issues, that you are really, undercutting them again, because they don't have the power and they haven't had the opportunity. Nevertheless, seems to me you have to have some balance of letting groups assert their interests as a regulative principle, but above it you have to have people who are seeking the common good for everybody in the world, today and tomorrow, with all the problems. And it won't happen from the balance of interests, whether they're collective interests or private interests. Although that is a regulative principle, I would never give it up as a regulative principle.
That's not the philosopher king. It's Plato's Republic, in a way, we're looking for.
Well, I'm more Aristotelian. We're looking for a balance of aristocratic and democratic principles. Aristocratic principles, aristocrat would have sought to study and to think about and to be shaped by a culture which would provide some sense of what the common good is, as over again simply taking him as a representative of the people who elect him. There are two principles here, the democratic and the aristocratic. And, you know, we have the Supreme Court is an aristocratic element in our own. We don't have enough aristocrats, I think, in our
really?
Own.
Really? We don't have enough aristocrats?
Yeah. That is to say, cultural aristocrats, philosophical aristocrats, people who, and human, in the sense that they've been nurtured by a tradition which shapes their whole being. And I think our Christian tradition does that as best. It shapes your whole being. So that you are concerned. You feel, you have a different person. You have a big self that goes out to the ends of the earth, that feels the feelings of others. It's like, let me read you their quote from John Winthrop here, which embodies, and I use it simply so you're not hearing me, Winthrop. He said, he described a city set upon a hill that he and his fellow Puritans intended to found. We must delight in each other, make other conditions our own, others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body. Now, if you universalize that to the world, you have a being, but you've got to be socialized into that. Now, that's what the church is about, so far as I can see.
I think of a recent conversation we had with some people in Poland, in Seattle, and on the peace issue. They were all for peace. We don't want the Soviet Union and the United States to get into a more aggressive exchange. And this lady from Poland says, well, I don't just want peace. So you got to be kidding me. She says, no, I don't want peace. So you're a fat cat sitting over here in Seattle. You want peace. Because you don't want to lose Seattle. Then I get blown to bits. But I'm sitting over there in Poland, and it's shitty. I don't want peace. This is what peace is. I don't want it. So I wonder if this book is written by a bunch of white, male, powerful men, isn't it?
Sure.
And they want to preserve what they've got. See? And they're going to do it by trying to make everybody happy with their lot. And I'm going to be interested in your condition.
No. They are absolutely opposed to the psychotherapeutic approach. They take the psychotherapeutic notion of making everybody happy and doing things that bring a kind of peace and adjustment and so forth. They are against that. Oh, they take that down. And that's what they think we are, chiefly.
But even being an aristocrat, like Mary Daly, Boston University, for her to be an aristocrat is a whole different tradition. She sees the whole Western tradition just to be, you know, stinking patriarchy.
Well,
and so if you're going to, you know, spend your time studying Aristotle,
you're
no friend of hers.
I wouldn't say I studied Aristotle, but I think you'd apply the principle, namely that you've got to have people who become citizens who are interested in the common good. She's interested in the common good. She just thinks there are dimensions of it that have to be changed radically. That, you know, the black is the same thing, and the Indian is the same thing, and the Central Americans and the third world people are the same thing. I mean, they have to be included somehow in the picture of the common good.
Do you sense the suspicion that I hear from these desperate groups?
Oh.
An attempt to try to do something common? This seems the way you're covering your ass.
I agree.
You're trying to keep yourself safe.
Protect
your pension.
Jim Cohn cut my head off when I raised that point up here one year. So I'm aware of it. Let's move on. I think you got a real point.
Well, I think mine is similar, and I'm going to risk being noxious by asking you if your bias, and perhaps the author's bias, has to do with the fact that your interest in work towards the public good has also meant that you could make a living at it.
That I would make a living at it?
You could make a living at the same time as you're doing that. Now, there are people in my age who have worked in these companies. I usually don't announce this because it's one of the stupidest things I ever did, but I have a doctorate in music, and I did that not only for myself, but because I thought it would be good for community to have a tradition. And I'm never going to make a living at that. If I wasn't married to a rich preacher, I'd be out on the street with him. For me to hear this is to hear something idealistic, that when it comes down to survival, doesn't work. And I know that there are many people in my
that's a problem. That's really a problem. I'm retired. I retired in 78, so I can do anything I want. And it doesn't matter more or less as long as the economy keeps going. But pension comes in a few things like that, which I'm completely dependent on. So that's another bias. Well, I don't have to earn a living. Neither I nor Sarah have to do a lick of work. So we can fuss around with all these things. It's a great problem in our community as to how you attach yourself to efforts to deal with the inequalities of the black community with which we're dealing, or anything which we think is creative and not simply instrumental, but great problem for people to earn a living. And we try to help people get cut off from these, but it's very hard to get them cut off because you got to have the money. We got to have the money to keep our building going. And so we need some people with some income.
Well, on the other side of the issue, half of my family worked in the nuclear industry over at Hanford in Washington. And they make good living, they have good jobs, and they're not just in it for that reason. They are moral people. They are not just making bombs to destroy the world. They think that nuclear energy can help
save the world. Well, they certainly take a strong stand against nuclear energy. The threat of nuclear destruction is one of the results, they say, of this individualism, and it's got to be dealt with. That's one of the outcomes of our present style of life, which they are very critical of, and use as a ground for trying to move in a different direction. Anybody else? Jody?
Al, I think there are a lot of sub-themes in this book case, but one of the things that it seems to me you're underemphasizing is the utility of this book as really a trenchant piece of social analysis. I mean, they really take apart the therapeutic view of what it is to be human, and in a way that I think is as convincing as anything I've ever read, and probably more so. Talking about the way in which thinking like a therapist and thinking like that therapeutic relationships are basically a combination of what you've got up there on the board as utilitarian individual and expressive individualism, that the language that we talk about being human with each other is so much now a product of that experience, of the therapeutic experience. And that's a middle-class American phenomenon, but it's another form of imperialism in a way. I mean, it's the way that one is an individual in modern culture. It's the language that defines what an individual is in modern culture. And I think they do a really convincing and marvelous job of sort of probing that and probing the limits of it. Talking with people who can't think more than an hour sort of their lives at once, think about more than an hour of their lives, about the immediacy of the utility of the interaction. Like that. It just seems to me that the probing of language, the probing of limits to community is really the muckraking side of this book is really well done. I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I think you could probably spend a day at least, I mean an hour at least on every chapter if you were. I'm just introducing you to the thrust of the book.
Somebody loved it.
I found it was interesting on talking about looking for a common good and not being, or you know, sort of not being able to find it or finding it too difficult or being a power thing. I guess sometimes I keep going back to the Native communities because I'm familiar with them in the North. You go up into the Northwest Territories where you have a group of people, they don't start their meetings on time. In fact, they certainly work with a different time schedule, but they work by consensus, and they do, everyone speaks, the children speak, the old people speak. It may take 3 weeks to come to a decision for what has to be done, but it's done by consensus. There's no feeling that one particular person or one particular group is taking the power and using it to close the mouths of others, because they're all given time to speak. The grandmother may get up, she may speak for an hour and a half. Nobody tells her, well, you have 10 minutes limit, you have to sit down now. She speaks until she's ready to sit down and has said all that she wants to say. And I think what you have, in small pockets in the communities that are still following that traditional form, you have people that do work for a common good and a common moral value. And it's done by consensus, but we are all too impatient to take the time to do that and to allow everyone to speak and to say what they have to say. And so obviously people feel that they are cut off or made to be quiet and not able to get their point across. And I'm not sure how we can do anything about that, but I think it's important for us to be aware that there are cultures and there are people that can make that kind of thing work, perhaps not on a grand scale, but it can work.
And rather than just looking towards the common good, I think they talked about, well, they did talk a lot about communities of memory, that it's a looking back, it's getting reconnected. And how far back you look, you see, you know, a lot of global concerns. I think if you can look far enough, everything becomes related, where the biblical tradition then comes alive. Another point, too, is I think that they talk more about this individualism of not how hard I am working now, me, myself, and I, but how hard I can project to you that I'm working. It's more important that I let you Here. Think that I'm hard working than the fact that I'm hard working. And that's a problem, or that I'm working for the common good.
Well, I think maybe we should get ready for the first sitting. And let's close with a prayer. If anyone wants to offer a prayer for us, please feel free to do so. And then I'll close with a short word. Oh God, help us to see ourselves as you see us. Help us to listen to each other, to be gentle and yet be rigorous and truthful as we see the truth. May the conversations here be truly holy, blessed by thee, and may we be opened up to what people have to say, even when it cuts us to the quick and challenges everything that we are, that together we may find new ways and reappropriate old ways.